For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Dr. Jason Old here, surfer, historian, world traveler, and your host of the Surfing Historian Podcast. This season, we'll be diving deeper into the nuanced world of surfing and examining the historical, cultural, philosophical, and even scientific elements of the sport we're all stoked on. So let's paddle out together and ride through the world of academia. This episode is sponsored by Banana Bag Oral Solution. These are definitely not your typical dehydration supplement. In fact, they're my personal go-to after a long surf session when I'm looking to avoid exhaustion and dehydration. Check them out at bananabag.org and use promo code STAYSTOKED for 10% off your purchase. You'll also get free shipping if you join their mailing list. Joining me today from San Diego, California is Dr. Bree Iatarola. Bree holds a PhD from UC San Diego in communication, and her areas of teaching and research expertise include environmental communication, community science, political ecology, and surf politics. She's currently teaching for the 7th College's Synthesis Program at UC San Diego and is also an invited instructor for a class on the history of television for the Television, Film, and New Media Critical Studies program at San Diego State University. For today's episode, we'll be chatting about the historical transformation of El Salvador and other parts of Central America as a result of surf tourism. Her research in this area is what initially connected us in the first place. In addition to our discussion on El Salvador and what Bree calls a wavetopia, we'll also be discussing the impacts of sea level rise at trestles since 2016, as well as the environmental challenges that coastal communities, such as those in San Clemente and Southern California more broadly, face. We'll conclude the episode with a brief word on her ocean and nature-related writing and research project, something she'll be working on heading into the upcoming academic year. I'm super stoked to have you on the show to share your passion for research, writing, and surfing with our listeners. I'm also personally thrilled to be able to chat with you one-on-one about your work in El Salvador, a place that I've been going to and surfing since the late 1990s. But before we get started, I want to personally thank you, Bree, as well as our listeners, for being part of this episode of The Surfing Historian.
Thanks so much for having me here, Jason. I'm really excited to share my old research with you and new research and talk all things surf, especially. And I love that you have this podcast going. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm, you know, obviously super stoked to have you here. You know, your research, particularly on Central America, was, you know, I would say not only inspirational, but instrumental in helping me realize that I could write what I wrote about Nicaragua. And, you know, like we've already said, this isn't about me, this is all about you. So we're going to talk about your specific research on El Salvador. And, you know, you wrote a master's thesis titled Beyond the Waves, Economic and Cultural Effects of the Global Surf Industry in El Tunco, El Salvador. And, you know, I know it's been a little while since you wrote that, but what compelled you to focus on El Salvador specifically? And what is this work about? What is this research about?
Yeah, I think looking back and really these days being rather removed from the country, the people I'm connected with, a lot of them through social media. So I see the trajectory and I see the changes since I did my field work down there, 13 years ago. But what compelled me to focus on El Salvador stemmed from being a child and wondering what is happening when I would watch the news with my family. I'm like, what is happening in this country that I don't know anything about, but I know that it's having an impact on the United States population in relationship with Central America, El Salvador specifically. And then being an exchange student actually in the early 2000s and traveling throughout Nicaragua and Costa Rica and going, all right, in Panama, and also going, I wanna see what the waves in El Salvador are like. And I had a t-shirt, from Hurley with a tag, Hecho in El Salvador. And I went, all right, there's something going on with the surf industry's apparel. And then I wanted to understand why, and especially after reading surf magazines when they were in print, why this country was being characterized as a really dangerous kind of guys only surf spot. I'm like, all right, I'm a woman, I'm going to test this out and see, are the descriptions matching my experience here as a woman, as a researcher, and as a surfer? And so I decided El Salvador's size, it was easier to actually get to the waves compared to other parts. I could have gone back to Costa Rica because I do have a host family and I've been there several times, but I was really more interested in the volatility of the region too, and trying to see how, if surfers recognized there was surf potential there, what other things were happening that kind of warranted some exploration. And so that's what drove me down there. And then I received funding from the Tinker Foundation to go do a little bit of ethnographic research and interview people. And so I thought, well, I don't have a lot of time. I am a single parent surfer. What can I do in this unrealistic time frame for a master's thesis? And that's kind of why I thought I would go back for a PhD, because if they were willing to fund research for surfing and surf research as a master's, I was like, surely I could figure out a way to keep this theme going and write more critically about the surf industry and surf tourism in other projects. So that was kind of like the genesis of my desire to go down there, and then accessibility to waves, just interest in media representations of surf culture in El Salvador, my desire to push the narrative, being somebody who did not grow up surfing, who did not grow up in California. I'm from Arizona. It's like, what's this Zoni doing here south of what quote unquote, the United States' cultural background? It's like, I'm going to bring something to these discussions that are now emerging that kind of push against the way that we write about surf research too.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. And, I know I've already told you this before, and I think our listeners might at this point start getting tired of hearing me say this about all of you that I interview, virtually all of you, but your work, along with a number of others, really helped legitimize my research. And so I really, want to just thank you for that. And, setting out on this, your research and doing something like this, it's really, it was inspiring, and it really helped, like I said, legitimize what I did for my PhD. But, so historically, you mentioned, some of the historical, conditions in El Salvador. Let's, would you mind walking myself and the listeners through this historical transformation? Something you really document well, but the historical transformation of El Salvador into this from a place that was a conflict zone throughout the 80s and up until 1992, and then evolved into this, really what it is now, this surf tourism location, destination. So can you walk us through this transformation?
Sure. No problem. I think I opened up my master's thesis to be like, what the heck did I write about? How am I writing about history? And so I guess I can kind of, the period of time that I can talk about central to my research would be maybe 2010 and forward. But I do know, you know, once the peace accords were signed in 1992, not that things were stable. You had mentioned that you were surfing down there, you know, as early as 1997. And from my dates might be off here because I haven't reread my thesis, but I do recall late 90s, probably 1998, I was really fixated on like getting to the coast and surfing when I graduated from high school. And so a lot of what I was seeing about El Salvador and surf magazines was kind of showing this move away from the volatile, conflict-ridden, violent, communist, civil war-stricken area into like, hey, we have established peace between warring factions. How do we generate economic revenue for not just the country, but our coastal communities that have in certain regions, right? The area I went to in past research was described as really conflict driven. But when I started talking to, you know, the locals and people who had visited that area, it was kind of more, we're talking El Sunsal and El Tunco, which is where the International Surfing Association's been hosting Surf City. Now they have like a kind of moniker of Surf City. You know, I think by 98, there was more coverage, media coverage of El Salvador's this quote unquote emerging surf destination with a great deal of economic potential, empty waves. No one's there. Hey, if you're searching for your dream destination and warm water and easier access with that kickback Central American lifestyle, if you don't want to deal with Costa Rica's crowds, come down to El Salvador. You know, I was like, this is really interesting. Let's see what it's about. And so early 2000s, I would say Lonely Planet starts giving before there was GPS and Google Maps and all the stuff that people, tourists use today, and the quote, internet surfers from Surfline are just monitoring conditions and hopping on planes for quick, you know, 4-day trips to surf and then leave, which has had a great cultural impact on towns like El Sunsal and El Tunco. There was a push to like generate more interest and bring more people in and to defy the stereotype that El Salvador had no waves. It wasn't imagined unless, you know, you're on the under the radar and you have inside connections. It's not being depicted as this, I call it in the, you know, master thesis, the Wavetopia. But it's not being depicted as a place really that doesn't have any potential anymore. It was more of like, where do we go now that we've established peace as a country, as people, and what do we do with this political environment that is very much painting us to the outside world, including the United States, as inhospitable to surf tourists and inhospitable to surf tourism. And I think, you know, by the time I got down there, I was like, there is a robust surf industry. People are making their own boards. Jaime, I interviewed Jaime. He's a huge board maker down there, a board shaper. And I feel like I've witnessed online the evolution of his own shaping industry, where he is like the front runner in the face of shaping in El Salvador and has his own line of boards now. And there he's, you know, creating boards in the hotel that he had for tourists. The roads were unpaved at that point. I'm not sure what the infrastructure was like. I sat in on a few community meetings where they were talking about potable water, agua potable, and I was like, yeah, where is the infrastructure? What is it? What's going to happen here with the influx of people recycling trash? At the time, people were just dumping their trash literally a mile inland from the beach. I'm like, with the rains and hurricane season in August, what are you going to do when all that stuff contaminates the very environment you want people to come surf in? The river had flooded, the estuary that led to kind of separated El Sunsal and El Tunco. I think environmentally, like the discussions about climate change in 2010 were not as prevalent as they are now, especially because El Salvador has had issues with hurricane season and mudslides and flooding and all of the things that come with the climate crisis, you know. But then it's like by 2010, I'm like, all right, it's not a budding industry. It seems pretty solidified now. It's just more about getting the tourism agencies on board. Bukele, like, I don't know if this is a good thing. I'm like, oh, suddenly popped up on my Facebook feed. I was like, does he have a Facebook profile? Is this legit? But is the president of El Salvador reading my work? And I could see through academia.edu, a ton of readers were coming from El Salvador. And I think that was spurred by an op-ed that I wrote, and I translated some of my work into Spanish to El Faro Académico, which is kind of the online academic journal for people who want a more critical discussion about policies in El Salvador, tourism being one of those arenas of interest. And I had seen also while I was there, you know, and this is again 2010, a push to privatize access points to the beach. And so I highlighted this, you know, you can only do so much in a master's in a 2 to 3 year program. You spend most of your time attending seminars, and then they're like, here, go where you need to go and do your research. And it's very extractive based. And so looking back, I'm like, I want to reconnect with Salvadoreños simply so that they understand from a cultural viewpoint, I wasn't there to extract. If anything, I've been witnessing the transformation through digital media and seeing how social media has very much played an interesting role in recharacterizing a region that was once considered like untouchable, not necessarily for surfers, but for your average tourists who kind of like the beach. And so, yeah, I think since then, you know, stepping through 2010 to 2023, major changes that I have seen post-peace accords, way more development, a lot more concern about sustainable development, pushes to draw in an international surfing crowd through the ISA's establishment of the championships there, and Bukele's whole focus on Surf City. This kind of the cultural dilemma that comes with, I don't know, everyone's got a Surf City. Huntington Beach is Surf City. You know, it's like, well, every touristic hotspot will have some way to monetize, capitalize, and commodify waves and surfing. And that can be great if your town never really had reliable economic productivity other than, you know, in El Salvador, I'm thinking of the coffee and mono exports, right? And coffee as being kind of a gift to the rest of the world. And now it's like, well, it's not just coffee, it's sports and it's surfing specifically. And how do we bring more tourists in while also navigating the environmental and cultural effects of it and the political impacts, right? Like this tension between the United States and El Salvador and kind of the neglect that happened post-peace accords and Reagan's policies that very much created this neoliberal industry where it's a Wild West free-for-all, pick up your plot of land, figure out how to work with Salvadoreños. I remember talking to a couple there they had to contend with Aquila rent from Mara Salvatrucha, you know, and I was like, how do we work with the cartel system plus environmental issues and budding infrastructure that is not quite regulated in the ways that you see in other coastal communities? And then to me now, I'm like, the discussion should be shifting toward what coastal resilience strategies does El Salvador have on hand to mitigate the impacts of rising sea levels, the influx of tourists who don't give a shit about their carbon footprint or their environmental footprint, and they're there, you know, to get their waves and to get their surf experience and to go to their surf camp or to go to their, you know, five-star hotel where they have, I think Putamango maybe, where you have like unfettered free-for-all access for a select 5 people who paid enough to have those waves all to themselves. And good for you, but not great for Salvadoreños who are like, where's my piece of the pie here? You know, and I won't speak on behalf of them, but I think some driving questions I had initially were for the research, you know, 13 years ago, it's like, what are the economic impacts here? What are the cultural impacts? How do we know? And moving forward, now I'm like, how do you get people to recognize that sea level rise is a real thing? And I can talk more about that through my dissertation research, but also, like, what are you going to do politically if you have, you know, I've been watching Bukele Bitcoin. I had a researcher reach out and was like, do you know anyone who writes about surfing in Bitcoin? And I was like, I'm sure that there'll be opportunities to discuss, but no, and I'm not sure I'm into the whole cryptocurrency as a means of economic productivity for surf tourism if it doesn't benefit the locals, especially, you know, or it leaves, I don't know, Bukele is very much about national security and creating a harmonious environment, and then he's imprisoning thousands of people who are considered a cultural threat, right, because of their gang affiliations. And so that's kind of like where I'm looking at with future interests. And I'm really glad that you spent a year in Nicaragua, because to me, I had 3 weeks to do field work, which is really unrealistic to cultivate relationships that really help you understand those nuances of politics, not just surf politics, but governmental politics, environmental politics, and then this whole dimension of cleaning up your country because you don't want the face of the Mara Salvatrucha history or FMLN tension, right, kind of characterizing the way people relate to the people, the Salvadoreños in particular. So that's kind of, I would say, if I had to put a timetable, by 2010, when I was down there in El Tunco, you know, 45 minutes by microbus outside of San Salvador, the capital, it was very much not emerging. It just seemed solidified in its own potential. And it was just more of like, how do we change the PR pitch here so that gringos don't think this isn't a place for them, but also retain our autonomy so we don't lose our land, which was what, to me, fundamentally, the Civil War was about: land and the landowning elite and peasantry and the rebellions to reclaim some kind of connection with the land that was very much lost in privileging a select few capitalists at heart, you know?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, just the we could do a whole episode on the nuances of, you know, the Civil War of in El Salvador. And the, you know, similarly, we could do that for Nicaragua. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, you and I have talked about this a lot. There's a lot of overlap between what, you know, my research and your research. And, you know, as you pointed out, I had the good fortune of living in Nicaragua. And keep in mind, you know, I'd been going back and forth since 2004. You know, I originally worked at a surf camp there. And so I do, you raise a really good point. You know, the relationships that you build, the trust you build, and just seeing for yourself the changes, I think was at least in my view, key to being able to produce the dissertation I did. Because without the trust of people there, without, you know, that deep that deep history, that deep trust, and just sort of seeing what's been going on really helped me. So I totally understand exactly what you're saying about that. And, you know, there's just so much to talk about with this in your research. You know, I know you and I have talked about this already, but I was, yeah, you were right. I was there in 1997 and, you know, I was back in El Salvador. I can't, you know, not that pre-COVID, but not that long ago. And just to see the radical transformation from a place that, you know, my college girlfriend, who I'm, you know, I'm still very much friends with her family and her cousin was the one that took me to surf in 1997. You know, we surfed Punta Roca with, I think it was maybe double overhead. The first day I show up to this place, you know, Dawn Patrol, probably out of my league, and there was no one out, you know, and to think of surfing Punta Roca now virtually alone is probably inconceivable unless some crazy thing happened. But I want to come back to a word you used, though. Use the word Wavetopia. And as I've said to you before, I did use that in my dissertation and gave you credit because I just think it's so simple and succinct in how it describes both this La Libertad area or even El Salvador more broadly. And I used it to describe Popoyo or Tola in Nicaragua. But, you know, since I have you here to ask specifically, I want to know what you mean by this term, because I know what it means to me and how I understood it. But I want to know what it means. What is this word? What does it mean to you, or how do you define it?
Oh, this is a great question. I reopened the thesis just to be like, what was my conceptual framework here? What was I thinking about when this term just popped into my head? And it was really coming from the way that my advisor, or she became my dissertation advisor, but she was one of my committee members when I was writing the master's. And she described a cafe that was kind of representing a utopian setting. And I was like, utopia in El Salvador. I wonder if I can convince people that this is possible. And I remember in high school having a very like vicious debate that there's no such thing as a utopia. And I was like, yeah, there is. If you're a surfer, it's perfect waves, whatever conditions you want. Nobody's in the lineup. You have it all to yourself. You have this symbiotic relationship with the water, the elements, and no other humans, you know, at least in my view, like it's kind of human free. And I thought about how you, growing up reading surf magazines specifically, like Surfing and Surfer, and always seeing the captions that captions kind of describing a perfect day, no people. Aaron Chong Ching, I'm butchering his last name. I want to say Chong, but I'm like, everyone says Aaron Chang. His work, The Flame, Larry Flame, I forget, famous photographer who had passed. There was this consistent theme in the way that they captured in their photography waves without people except one. And like, you know, the quintessential surf shot where whether it's double overhead or, you know, you're a longboarder and it's that perfect waist high day where you're, you know, hanging 10, whatever it might be, you're not sharing. And that's kind of like the antithesis to me and like what we need collectively to save waves or to protect waves is like we have to learn to share. But when it's a Wavetopia, it's like they're going to be there forever. They're not going to change. They're not going to be impacted, whether or not you believe in climate change, by climate issues. They're going to remain consistently reliable for your, you know, surfing pleasure. And you do not have to worry about that moment that you have with that wave connection being disrupted by something beyond your control. And I was like, well, I think that's possible for anyone who's surfed and you've had a perfect day where you're like, yes, this is like the reason for living, you know. To me, a Wavetopia captures that relationship, the liminal space between body, mind, and environment, if you will, in which you really have found what I believe is like some form of perfection on earth, you know? And so that's for me, I was like, yeah, Wavetopias exist. And then you see how in the touristic, you know, economic sense, you have, you as somebody who is in El Salvador's case, it was like, how do we draw in the tourists and convince them that we can compete with a country like Costa Rica, we can compete with Nicaragua. I'm waiting for it to happen to Guatemala. You know, I'm like, I know the waves aren't usually written about as great there, but I know people who've surfed there who are like, yeah, man, no one's out. And I'm like, that's usually why, you know, you keep seeking these spaces is because you don't really want to share and have your experience with nature. And if you believe in God or the higher order, or the creator, it's like, there's no one there to disrupt that connection. There's not machinery in the background or boats, or now it's like drones. I wish I had a little thing I could shoot every drone in the water, you know? But that would be like the fundamental framework. I mean, theoretically, looking back, it was influenced by Alana Zilberg's work because she described this cafe in El Salvador, La Luna, is like a utopian setting where you could remove yourself from the war, right? And the drudgery of civil conflict. And then Henri Lefebvre's whole production of space, the French philosopher. Looking back, I'm like, there have got to be Central American researchers and writers who also write about the production of space in Spanish, where I can build on that in the future, and you too, you know. But I also think theoretically, I was thinking through Alan Gutmann's whole framework for how does a lifestyle like surfing become a sport? And you need, part of that framework is like, you need a setting where you can have a competition or an active activity, a sport activity, be executed and people follow the rules. And so I was like, in a Wavetopia, people get it. There's like a golden rule, right? No dropping in, no being a dick, no splashing and creating like an environment in which there's tension. It's like, we can all get along and we can recognize that the set of rules in place, the etiquette, if you want to call it that, is not going to be violated. That social contract between surfers is honored, or those other surfers just aren't there. And this is how I was thinking through Wavetopia. Now I'm like, let's add the dimension of environmental politics and climate change, because, you know, we see, to me, a Wavetopia has now become this artificial wavescape, like in Ojai with the surf ranch, where you're creating and simulating perfection from the ocean in this man-made, man-driven environment. And for some people, that's going to be their Wavetopia. This is what Wavetopia means. It's going to have to adapt to industrialization and not modernization, because I feel like things have already been modernized with the whole shift toward globalizing surfing as an industry. But I would say, yeah, maybe the intervention that comes from other scholars too is like, if we think of something possible as a Wavetopia, that means that we can simulate these ideas in spaces that typically we don't, you know, there's no ocean, lakes, reservoirs. We see how creative people get when they just want a piece of the pie. And I love that. And then I also am like, I have some questions, especially environmental and political ones, and that will emerge in due time, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, I knew that your sort of understanding or coining of this term was way more nuanced than I, you know, and than the way I was using it. You know, I was looking at it as this place that I think you also use the commodification of waves, or you also use another term. I hope I'm not butchering it, but the veil of engineered serenity. And, you know, when I thought about that, like this, the veil of engineered serenity and this Wavetopia, I used it to describe this space that had been in effect colonized by outsiders, which is the case essentially of, say, the Popoyo area of Nicaragua, and to a, you know, maybe a similar extent that La Libertad, the El Tunco area, maybe a little to a lesser extent, but that idea that they've created this space that is utopian in nature, in that the surf conditions are perfect, and it's, you know, we would probably call it like a surf paradise, if you will.
Right.
But as you were talking, you know, I was thinking about this, you know, the life cycle of a Wavetopia would be this, in its inception would be utopian in nature, but as the Wavetopia grows and comes to include more people, you get, you know, it becomes more localized and territorialized. And so there's got to be a life cycle to this Wavetopia. But, you know, I won't even touch the wave pool stuff because that's a whole another episode in and of itself. And but Bree, I do want to get into your current research, which is on sea level rise and trestles. And you say trestles since 2016. And I guess my question, two parts. Why since 2016? And also, why trestles?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals.
Save big money at Menards.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Well, yeah, thanks. That's a great question, Jason. Like, why trestles and why this particular point in history? And one is, I did field work for the Urban Tides Initiative through the University of Southern California. And also, they were collaborating with the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And I think one lesson that I learned moving away from El Salvador and being a PhD student and realizing, you know, I was expected to do a year of field work, and realistically, could I do a year of field work in El Salvador? And I, you know, as I said, I 24/7, I'm a single mom, and the reality of trying to do research there with my son and his own schedule pushed me into, okay, I need something more local. And also, like, I need something more accessible that's going to help me. My time, normative timeline was reduced because I did my research on El Salvador, and the UC system assumed through their design of the PhD program that you would just continue that. And that was initially the objective. I was like, I've got my relationships established here. I'm going to go back. But things were uncertain too politically. It's just a little bit of instability. And we saw the shift with immigration and migration patterns, climate refugees, if you want to call them this, you know, coming north. I'm living in San Diego, the caravan. We've had a lot of poignant moments with the influx of immigrants who are grappling with environmental crises that are removing them from their homes. And I'm like, I need to focus on a place where I know I can drive to it. And I was like, well, when I first applied for the master's at that time, I want to say 2007, 2008, before I applied, Surfrider had sent all their members a survey on trestles. And I was like, okay, I know the toll road is an environmental, you know, problem here, and things will. The rulings were like, yes, trestles is saved. No, it's not. You need to stay engaged. Yeah, trestles is saved. No, it's not. You need to stay engaged. And I was like, okay, this, and I personally don't think, A, you can save trestles from sea level rise, and B, you know, right now, Mike Levin is the, his seat is kind of up for debate in the incoming election. I'm like, we can look to trestles with this connection to Nixon and the EPA, because the Western White House was located there. And, you know, the San Onofre State Beach and the issues about the nuclear generating station songs were under a really incessant debate. And I'm like, we don't know what we're going to do with this nuclear generating station. A lot of people are questioning whether or not the toll road issue is dead. And some of those same themes were happening at Trestles, and it was just a lot more local. And I think that was also a realization as a PhD student, was like, while you might not make connections with people because Trestles has the same kind of global influx of tourists, it's such a, you know, preeminent spot to surf. I mean, we know this from the surf industry's contest. I was interested in really critiquing, like, what are you doing? You're holding an annual contest here. And I was there when it was like, sorry, you can't surf in this zone. And I'm like, you have literally privatized temporarily these waves for your industry that you expect people to be spectators of, but they can't even watch this year's contest because they have to move inland because there's too much water. And so I was thinking about, like, why Trestles, and 2016 was when I started fieldwork, but it was also El Nino. And during this time period, I started seeing pretty visible environmental impacts just happening in San Diego with the water in the King Tides. And so I joined the Urban Tides Community Science Initiative because the premise was that anybody could be a community scientist if you had a smartphone. And I'm like, that seems legit. Let's see how good this data collecting process really is. And so one of the questions I had was, well, how can somebody with a non-science background document sea level rise? And is their data usable? And I was just like, are they going to use my data? And they, meaning the USGS. But USGS would use your data and map your photos of sea level rise to show patterns in change, and compare the data that quote unquote community scientists or citizen scientists collected with their phones, and compare and kind of use that data to determine whether or not tide lines were moving closer to coastal communities. And while I was there, San Clemente was not entirely at peace, I think, with the toll road issue. And also, when I started doing field work by April, there were so many die-offs of marine life, and everyone who I would talk to just casually and not record their interviews, they were like, oh yeah, this is normal. And I'm like, well, I don't know if it's normal for somebody from Tucson, Arizona, when you're like, 1 week you're watching thousands of pelagic sea crabs dying, like gasping for air. And you're like, okay, waters are warming. Another week you're seeing like the dead sea slugs, just thousands. And you're like, is this legitimately normal? Because we're due for El Nino, you know, all the dire gloom and doom message making happening on media right now is like, El Nino 2024 is going to be a shit fest. And I'm like, well, what happens in these landscapes? I love talking about how spaces are produced. How do trestles go from Oshiman territory to, private territory to the O'Neill family, to then military Camp Pendleton, militaristic territory, all of these intersections of territories changing, and then stakeholders, including the Oshiman, including the National Resource Defense Council, all of these environmental stakeholders and cultural stakeholders and surfers and governments coming together and kind of going, we don't want this toll road. And I thought that was interesting because being a surfer, I'm like, they keep framing, the media, like San Diego Union Tribune, Orange County Register, keep depicting this as like a surfer battle. And it obviously wasn't, but I also was like, it's which surfers, you know, it takes me 45 minutes by car on a good day of traffic to get here. And yet this place is so popular and it's so contingent. San Clemente is a town like El Tuco, you know, and El Sunsal were very much contingent and on surf tourism revenue. And a lot of that came from the annual pro tours that High Tops Destination that brought millions in revenue for the city of San Clemente. And that's why, you know, a lot of city surfers from, or San Clemente surfers were like, no, this is like central to our identity, but also our economic livelihood. And you're not going to build this god-awful toll road that's going to destroy endangered species and destroy a baptismal site, the oldest site to indicate like colonization, you know, in California. And I was really interested by those dynamics. I realized, you know, when you want to do research with indigenous groups, you can't, in the same way of just going to El Salvador and being like, can I talk to you? Those relationships are very much fractured because of the history of genocide in California's indigenous communities, San Diego included with the Kumeyaay. And so it's kind of like I didn't know how to write about that and intertwine it with science. And in that, I was like, why did I pick a PhD in communication? I really wanted to be a biologist. I'm first an architect and then a biologist. And I'm like, how did I end up in the social sciences when my heart was in science? And it made me think about access to science, gatekeeping in science. And I'm like, okay, I'll do this project and I'll do an ethnography of a community science project to see how legit it is. What I realized is when all was said and done, I went on a weekly basis, usually, and documented a sea level rise according to the instructions of the geographers and the oceanographers at Scripps. They're like, here's where you need to stand. This is what you need to do. Then you upload your work to, at the time it was Liquid Database, they went broke. And that's what I realized. I'm like, I just collected data for you for a year. This was supposed to be a public service, a public enterprise with publicly accessible data, and it disappeared. They told us to export our data about maybe 6 months after I defended in 2018. And I just went, holy shit, like, we really need to think critically about public databases of scientific data that can disappear when we're leading, we're trying to collaborate and use technology to help our environment. And then we don't have access to that data when all is said and done. And I realized too, by being at, you know, San Onofre State Beach is technically owned by the Marine Corps, U.S. Marine Corps, and it's leased to the state of California. Historically, it used to be like a penny per year. It's kind of part of this whole public service, keeping open space parks, keeping state parks a public good. So the idea of the commons in a public good and people having pretty easy access to trestles through the Pawnee Trail, but also the emergency service road. There were all these interesting dynamics happening, and at the core of it was like, is the toll road going to get built? At this point, I'm like, I mean, it's supposed to be rendered totally like never buildable. And I'm like, never say never, because it really depends on who's in power, how invested people are. And that's why I'm like, as much as you hate people in the water, if there's nobody surfing, no one gives a shit. They just look at it as an empty space, you know, that could be used for other purposes. Why else do you think a nuclear generating station got built there, you know, along a fault nonetheless, that like, hopefully we don't have a nuclear disaster, because if we did, I was looking at that, was like, how would the cities respond? And I saw this with the way that the cities of San Clemente and San Diego dealt with a beached juvenile gray whale that rolled ashore in San Diego. The Miramar landfill is almost near capacity. And so I'm like, well, all these die-offs are happening. Call El Nino regular environmental phenomena. But when you couple that with like the climate crisis, you're going to rely on these cities that are often ideologically opposed. Orange County, we saw during the pandemic, was anti-masks, revealed its true conservative colors. And then you get shifts of people leaving California altogether right now because of the housing crisis and the cost of living, which asks us to consider, like, who's going to take care of the coast? If your coastal elite move and they're not there, and you know, give this job to city governments, when people, especially if you're conservative, are like, keep the government out of my life and keep them off my beach, what game plan do you have when a dead whale rolls ashore? And so for 2016, like, so much weird shit happened. And I went, one, the actual space needs to be documented historically, so we understand that here's where we're at environmentally. Here's the issue, the toll road, you know, how many lanes, 8, 10, 12, 16. Eventually, it's just going to be a concrete jungle. you open up one avenue of development, you know the story there, you know, the rest follows, the hotels, the little cafes, and all of the things to generate touristic revenue, but that also put your surf culture and your surf industry on warning, because it's like, it doesn't always, we can make this money without surfers, you know, as long as you give us that developable land. And that's what San Onofre State Beach and State Park are, is potentially developable land. It usually starts with spaces that don't have the infrastructure, but once you get a project realized, such as a toll road, the realization is anything else then can be developable. And if you have sophisticated developers who can demonstrate surfing is not necessary to economic growth, that economic growth can happen through other touristic means, it kind of puts your culture's identity at risk too. And so I think I was a little critical of how newspapers in particular, being a journalism major from undergrad, were depicting the Save Trestles only about waves. And I was just like, nah, you can't save this landscape if you just make it about waves. The neglect of the indigenous history and the trope, I've listened to Dina Giulio Whitaker has written some awesome, she should be on your podcast. She's written some amazing work about trestles and indigenous mobilization, and that campaign could not have been realized without the indigenous and the environmental. And I had not read her work prior to my dissertation, but I think she has some fantastic arguments that are worth exploring, of like, what role does indigeneity play in protecting places like Trestles, you know, because Trestles, the people who came together were like, it's not just surfing, it's about the habitat, the endangered species, but it can't just be about that, because you know, if you're not an animal lover, you don't care. It's like, well, what about the indigenous history? And then the military, you know, I personally, my dissertation, what I realized doing fieldwork there from 2016 to 2017 was that I don't know if the Save Trestles campaign would have been effective if it weren't for the military to step in and be like, this is a national security issue. I was able to secure some letters that demonstrated the hesitation and reservations that the US Marine Corps had about creating something that gave you a front end center of Camp Pendleton training grounds. I was like, yeah, I don't think that's gonna fly with your military, you know? And I think what was unique about the Save Trestles campaign, beyond saving it, because that's my dissertation, is like this, you know, sea level rise. I'm like, I can't make that argument unless I'm there and I'm documenting sea level rise. I can't understand sea level rise unless I talk to scientists and geographers where this is their area of expertise. You know, from my positionality as a researcher, how did I end up in communication? Because I was told in high school, I couldn't be a scientist. You know, I had terrible high school science teachers, only one my freshman year. The others, you know, did a lot of gatekeeping. And I'm like, well, if we do, the surf culture does gatekeeping through territorialism and localism, right? And there are a lot of people, I'm sure people who are, you know, who listen to this and be like, why do you got to bring up people of color, marginalized communities, and all this woke BS? And I'm like, look, the reality is that Trestles is an affluent community. People would not care about your space unless you invited them into it to share the beauty of it. So learn to share, and learn to share coherently so that your, you know, ideology matches like what you want to save, quote unquote save. And equally, think about how, if we care about our oceans at large beyond surfing, how many people literally don't have access to it? And you know, coming from Arizona, I'm like, a lot of people hate the ocean. They hate the sand. They hate the traffic. They hate the parking. They won't go. That's not their place to go. It's the mountains, you know? So they're concerned about wildfires. And we're like, sea level rise. And then sometimes you develop like an Imperial Beach development. I remember reading Serge Dedina's research too. And it was like, if you reconfigure these urban landscapes, there is actually an interesting possibility that while you might destroy one wave, lowers, uppers, all of it, churches, right? You might create other, even better waves. I'm not saying that's what happened in Imperial Beach, but you know, it's like when we develop and we reconfigure and engineer, we can make hypotheses about what we think is going to happen to the landscape. And that's the beauty of the ocean. It's like, I got other plans in store and here's a new wave for you, you know? And it's like, then what do you argue? You're trying to protect like a set of 5 surf breaks that might not exist, not just due to sea level rise, but just basic shifting patterns of geologic activity. So make sure that it's not just about surfing, you know? And that was kind of what I got in these critical seminars, where I was around people who were like, A, sports don't belong in doctoral research. I'm like, well, I already had to argue that surfing is a sport when half of the people I know are like, anyone who makes it a sport is a sellout. I'm like, well, okay, there's a commodification reason involved in that, right?
As you're talking about, surfing or sports can't be in, you know, academic research, you know, I think that your work and, you know, my work too, and a number of others around the world are sort of turning that on its head and saying, no, it's precisely the opposite. We can study these issues through the lens of surfing, through the lens of sport. And I've joked around a bit on a number of episodes about the eye roll when you say, yeah, you know, I do research on surfing. It's like, okay, yeah, dude, you just want to go surf. Like, we get it. Like, just be honest with us. But it's more than that. And I think not only is this podcast and surfinghistorian.com and some of the other resources that are out there are showing like, no, this is a very serious field. These are very serious scholars, and we're doing amazing work to sort of explain things through the lens of a sport that we also happen to love. Bria, I want to go ahead and give you the last word. And it's really kind of a two-part last word. You did say it seems to me that in your view, trestles in terms of sea level rise and things like that is it's sort of past the point of no return. I don't want to put words in your mouth, of course, but that's how, at least as you were talking, that was what was coming to mind. But is it, so the two-part last word is it past the point of no return? And you know, what's the future of trestles look like? And then on top of that, you know, moving forward with your research, what's the new writing project? What's the new research all about? And so with that, I want to go ahead, Bri, and give you the last word.
Yeah, I prefer not to think pessimistically about it being past the point of no return. Realistically, this year, twice the surf liner discontinued rail service to San Clemente due to an eroding coast and due to the kind of destruction of the coastal line that goes from, at least here, you know, an old town, you can hop on the surf liner and go north up to LA and a little bit farther. And I think once we start to see visible changes happening to the transportation that takes us to these places, I know surfers who would hop on that surf liner to bypass the traffic with their bikes and, you know, figure out their own route so that they wouldn't have to drive. To me, I don't think it's the past the point of no return. I think it requires diligence and active vigilance to not assume anything can ever be saved. That's just realistically, the minute you get comfortable is exactly when the people who think very different from you exploit your moment of victory, you know. The research I'm doing, so stay vigilant, stay aware, stay informed, be active and critically conscious. The current research going into summer, one is unrelated to surfing, so I won't talk about that. But the other one is really thinking about these transformations and doing a comparative analysis of Costa Rica and El Salvador. I really want to go back to El Salvador. My son will be wrapping up high school in 3 years, so it's more of timing it and realizing, you know, I teach full time at 2 institutions, so what's realistic with my own workload? But I would like to do a comparative analysis, specifically focusing on property and privatization of the coast, and using the framework of community science to better understand how towns like El Tunco and towns like in Costa Rica. I went, my son and I went to Jaco in 2018, and I was just like, what happened to this town? What plan do the people have, Ticos have? I was there and there was a hurricane warning. I was like, what plan do you have when the inevitable happens, which is some kind of environmental phenomena, whether it's a hurricane or sea level rise? What's your plan? Because I've always been asked, what's my plan? And so I would like to revisit both spaces and kind of chart what I knew back in these graduate days, what I know now scientifically, but also culturally about climate communication and climate change, and how people who live in these coastal communities in Central America, where I learned to surf more in Costa Rica than I did anywhere else. What are the people who live in these coastal communities experiencing, and what are their thoughts on sea level rise in particular, since that was central to my dissertation?
If you enjoyed my conversation with Bree about her research on El Salvador and Southern California, I'd like to invite you to check out my next episode, where I'll be joined by Spanish social anthropologist, Dr. Ignacio Iturralde. Ignacio will be checking in from Ibiza, Spain, to chat with me about why he left his marketing job and embarked on a journey of self-discovery, eventually earning a PhD in social anthropology and committing himself to research and writing on the intersectionality of surfing culture and philosophy. If these are topics that get you stoked, then this will be an episode you won't want to miss. We also want to take a moment to thank Banana Bag Oral Solution again for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to check them out at bananabag.org. And while you're there, use promo code STAYSTOKED for 10% off your purchase. Be sure to join their mailing list too if you want free shipping. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Surfing Historian. If you're stoked on these conversations, be sure to share, like, and subscribe to never miss an episode. And don't forget to check out our killer merch at surfinghistorian.com. Proceeds go to help keep this amazing podcast going strong. Until next time, stay stoked.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP lawn and garden and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals. Save.